And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, as we mark our first day in a new headquarters, we'll be thinking about the importance of place. What's the connection between your content and your setting? We'll take a quiz that offers a glimpse of our television past, and as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor. I cover movies, theater, pop culture, that kind of thing for NPR.org.
We are without the services of Glenn Weldon this week, so we have with us our producer, Jess Gittner.
Yay.
Jess Gittner, what do you do at NPR when you're not producing Pop Culture Happy Hour?
I'm a producer with Morning Edition.
We should explain, we are taping this podcast for the last time, our 135th episode.
Mm-hmm. Wait, not the last time ever. This is like when I said, when I was talking about my mother as if she had died.
We are...
The podcast's on.
Of course, but we are, for the last time, in this building.
In this building.
Mm-hmm. We are in the old NPR HQ, where we have taped this podcast 135 times.
Right.
But next time we tape, we will be in our new headquarters. But Jess, for the time being, the rest of us have moved over.
Yeah.
Jess remains here.
Jess and a few other people are still here. What was it that our
writing
colleague Laurel said?
No.
It's like being the last to move out in college. Like, you're in this house.
Yeah.
Luckily, we don't have to vacuum.
But that's if all the other occupants trashed the dorms on their way out. If they were able to just, like, write on the walls.
Right. Yeah, I want you to know, Jess, that it is the responsibility of all of those of you who remain to make sure we get our security deposit back. But we have reunited here at the old HQ for the last time. But Stephen and Trey and I spent our first day today in the new HQ.
Swooning in the opulence of our new...
It's not opulent.
It's not opulent.
Mislead people. It is not fancy, but it is
new. It feels
new.
So opulent by comparison.
It is one of those things that it is like when you have a new car, that even if it's just a very plain, ordinary car, the fact that it is new and everything works.
Good analogy.
Yeah, it's absolutely
really
like...
Also, it smells like a new car.
Yeah.
And so you find out where the coffee is and where the cafeteria is and stuff like that. But we had a good time. We had a good time. And we thought that it would be appropriate to spend this week thinking a little bit about sense of place, because, of course, we have now relocated. And next week, as I said, we'll be doing the podcast in an entirely different location. Now, Stephen.
Yes.
NPR Music is, I would say, an example of an organization that has made use of sense of place.
Yeah, that has built one of its signature brands around a very distinctive visual that comes from entirely from a setting.
Mm-hmm.
Namely the Tiny Desk Concerts, mm-hmm. where, if for those who don't know, we have our favorite bands come and perform in our office. They perform for about 15 minutes behind the desk of NPR Music's Bob Boylan. And, you know, we do it as a free video podcast. And so much of that series is built around that visual, these very cluttered shelves behind him, this kind of grungy gray desk.
Mm-hmm.
And when you watch over the course of the series, 250, 270, however many we've done, we've been very, very concerned about moving that series to the new building where we've basically had to, in the midst of this gleaming, shiny, like not a speck of dust out of place building, we have to make it look shabby, look like we've moved the bookshelves. Nowhere else in the building have crummy old bookshelves been moved into the new building.
Yeah.
But we're trying to...
recreate the appearance of it as much as you can.
Yeah, I mean, talk about sense of place.
Yeah. Coffee stains, dust, and Adele.
Yeah.
Right, and,
yeah.
and it's going to be different. There's no way... it's not going to be different, but we still want the spirit of the series to remain, and it sort of remains to be seen. It's much higher ceilings in the new place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, acoustically, they could sound different.
They could sound different. I mean, that's an example of sort of very, very small scale sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
There are also obviously questions of very larger scale sense of place in culture and even outside of NPR.
Sure.
Like, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about what it's like when they make TV shows that are set in New York, because many, many, many shows are set in New York, but they vary enormously in how effectively they can convey anything about New York.
A sense of New York. This is one of the things I give that otherwise regrettable television musical drama, Smash, a little bit of credit for. Its sense of what living and working in the theater, gigantic apartments always accepted.
Right, of course.
But that's a pretty big exception.
The sense of working in the theater, both midtown and downtown, mm-hmm. is pretty true to life. I know lots of people who do that, and yeah. You know, I recognize a lot of the places they walk by on their show.
Yeah, I think few shows are able to give a really complete idea of a city like New York. But I do think there are some that find a way to convey individual things that feel very familiar to people mm-hmm. who live there. I even think, like, How I Met Your Mother. She's one of the characters is an anchor on what's essentially New York One. Mm-hmm. They don't call it New York One. But it's the idea that there's this hyper-local news station that kind of everyone knows, but it's really cheap-looking in a lot of ways, but kind of everyone loves it, and it's got the morning. They did a whole thing with the morning anchor who reads the newspaper, which is a real thing.
Yep.
So I think sometimes it's very helpful. It's almost impossible, like you said, because of the, you know, you've always got the sprawling apartments, which Friends, of course, was famous for. But sometimes you can find those individual details that will sort of nail, like, oh, yes, that feels like New York to me. Even if other times, when How I Met Your Mother had they depicted what the F train stop in Brooklyn at Smith and Ninth looked like. And it Smith and Ninth is really a very rundown mm-hmm. train station. And they made it look like it was like, you know, there was a flower stand outside. It was like, yeah, Smith and Ninth is nothing. It was
like
you
Victoria
know,
Station.
Well, there were like little brownstones everywhere. And Smith and Ninth is not surrounded by flower shops and brownstones. That's,
nice.
You know. So every once in a while they get something really super wrong, like Scandal when they said somebody was selling luxury cars in Tacoma Park.
Yeah. Like, no.
I was like, yeah, that would not so much happen.
Not happening.
How about you, Jess Gittner? Sense of place. Any thoughts?
Well, the thing I thought of, and Glenn isn't here to back me up here, but I thought of this video game that Glenn has actually talked about, Assassin's Creed.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially the same game, and there's now, what, 5-ish?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same game, but they're all taking place in different locations. So we've got various places in Israel, Syria, Italy, Rome, and then you get to Boston and New York, colonial Boston and New York. And I think I'm speaking from, like, a, you know, U.S.-centric place here, but Assassin's Creed 3 takes place in Boston, and it is almost too familiar to me to be exotic and enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it's less of an exploration. So I don't know, maybe people from New York feel like this when they watch Seinfeld, which I love for the annoyances of
right.
New York
that
it
are New
portrays.
York
specific. Crazy? What are you doing? Hey! You're stealing my space!
George, wait, you don't know who this guy is? People kill for a parking space in this city.
No, he's not getting away with this.
George!
Hey, what are you doing?
I think I'm parking my car.
You can't do that. You can't just sneak in from the back like that.
I'm not sneaking. I didn't even know you were parking. You were just sitting there 3 spaces up.
Well, if you didn't think I was parking, why did you put it in head first?
Well, that's the way I park!
Yeah, and when I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, they would occasionally shoot something there. They would shoot exterior shots for what some Keanu Reeves Chain Reaction. I think parts of Chain Reaction were shot around the Capitol. And in a small enough town, I think the novelty of, like, my little Hamlet has been captured mm-hmm. in celluloid is exciting to people. And, you know, and any time you can sort of play the part of the geek who's like, oh, that's not State Street. You know, I think there's more excitement when there's scarcity around that location.
Yeah, and being in D.C., I think I felt it most about D.C. shows, like Homeland. They showed Farragut North, and there was a fountain, and everyone was outraged. You know, or watching Veep, or watching... There's so many shows in D.C. that we can
I think there's a difference between sense of place as far as what you see, mm-hmm. and is it believable, and do you look at it, and do you see the right landmarks? Do you see, if you're a person who actually lives there, do you see things that look like the right things? Like I said about Smith and Ninth, like Jess is saying about mm-hmm. Farragut North. Versus those things that have to do with culturally the sense of place, the way New York feels, the way, you know, you can have all the scenes in Fargo that you want where there's snow and mm-hmm. there's hilly landscapes by the highway, you get all that.
But the minute characters start to talk and interact,
that's where mm-hmm. the sense of place really comes
yes.
from. And anybody who lives in that area can tell you that when they have the conversation with the guy who's shoveling his driveway, and the cops come up and talk to him. He tells the whole story, and he kind of has his parka. I think he has his parka on the whole time, and you know, he talks in the accent, mm-hmm. then he tells the whole story, and it's very friendly, this exchange. He's just a very matter of fact.
Mr. Mora?
Yeah.
Officer Olson.
Yeah, righto. Well, so I'm tending bar down there at Eklund and Swedlin's last Tuesday, and this little guy's drinking, and he says, so where can a guy find some action? I'm going crazy out there at the lake.
That's the best sense of place in Fargo. Not all the snow, not the costume design. It's the way that people behave. And I think it takes much more skill to capture those kinds of things, like how people in New York are about apartments versus the constant problems with Toronto doubling for every city in the world. Because they often, with Toronto, don't even bother to dress it up. You'll just see in the middle of something that's supposed to be in New York, you'll see a store that is an iconic Canadian brand.
Tim Hortons, although at least they do have a Tim Hortons on 9th Avenue now.
Well, there you go.
And sometimes they bother to work that stuff out, and sometimes they don't. But you have to always, if you're going to take seriously the idea that your story has a specific location, you have to get at least something's right that place you in that, you know.
Well, I remember when I was 7 years old, my family took a train ride to Denver and Boulder, Colorado, for like the World Science Fiction Convention. And my big memory of the trip was that we drove past the exterior of, quote-unquote, Mork and Mindy's house.
Yeah.
and feeling like I was witnessing, like, this is where Mork and Mindy happens, even though, of course, it is just a totally static postcard view of a house in Boulder, Colorado.
One of the things that's interesting about that story is my guess is that if you went back and watched Mork and Mindy, there's nothing about it that's particularly Boulderian.
No.
it would have been
a lot more hacky sack.
It was sort of supposed to be not New York, not L.A., not Boston, and so they just kind of picked a city. The same way that
Roseanne would pick a place in Indiana.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's a great example because I think that show had a wonderful sense of place even though it wasn't a specific real place.
Right.
There was always a sense that they lived in a real neighborhood and in a real town with a real mall and real place, a real bar and places that you knew and could understand even though it wasn't referencing a specific town in real life. That was going to be familiar to everybody in the same way as Chicago or something.
It came with a sensibility that was distinctly not coastal.
Right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I always believed that their town that they lived in existed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's another sense of place question. Like, does this fit the category? Again, a personal example, but I worked, as I've mentioned on this show before, I worked at The Onion for 12 years. And for a block of those years, The Onion was written out of Madison, Wisconsin. And then the comedy staff moved to New York. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, the comedy staff moved to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm sort of interested in the way that The Onion was perceived in those times as, like, this has a Midwestern sensibility. All of a sudden, they've gone New York. Oh, there's a joke about New York. Oh, they've gone New York. Mm-hmm. That people sometimes overlay assumptions.
So sense of place as in origin.
As in sense of place as in where art is actually made.
Right.
You know, and there's certainly, you know, New York actors and L.A. actors. You know,
mm-hmm. And there's understood to be a Chicago comedy sensibility. And that's a little different from the Toronto comedy sensibility and stuff like that. I think that's true.
And you certainly, you know, visual arts in particular often come extremely highly marked by a sense of place. I mean, the way light influences painters, for instance.
Yeah, I wouldn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
No, but I think it's true. I mean, I think what Stephen is saying is right, is that just as surely as a city can have a culture that's reflected in the content of fiction, for example, it has a culture that people believe is somehow reflected in creation.
And it was fascinating at The Onion to have all these like Midwestern people, like people who are Midwesterners to the core, would suddenly you plop them down in Brooklyn and suddenly supposedly their perspective is massively different. We were always sort of baffled by that assumption.
I do think
Over time, it did seep in because they would hire people.
And that's what I mean. I don't think there's necessarily a difference between writing a piece of comedy in Madison and taking the same people and having them write it in New York. I do think there's maybe a difference between the kind of comedy that gets written by people who lived all their lives in New York versus the kind of comedy that's written by people who lived all their lives in Madison. And I do think that the sensibility of The Onion, some of the things that The Onion has done that I love the most on the comedy side are things that really understand this kind of plugging along and yet a good person. Like, and even maybe having what is actually not a terrible life, and yet just this sense of kind of boredom and I think that is very Midwestern in feel.
Well, one thing that we talked about a lot around the office, you know, when there would be a new employee or you'd meet a new person, one of the big questions that particularly John Crewson, who was one of the editors there until fairly recently, John always had this whole thing about how he would ask each person, what is the worst job you've ever done for minimum wage?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of an element of snobbery to that, like, you better be poor, you better have been poor. But we would go around and try to one-up each other about, like, what the crappiest job we ever did for, in our case, $3.35 an hour was. And I think that fueled The Onion sensibility even more than regionally.
Right.
Well, Stephen, you might have more to say about this than I do, but I was thinking about record labels and how I lived in London for a year, and I would go to Rough Trade Records.
Right.
And I loved going there because when I would go to some top 25 list on some American blog, it would just barely overlap with Rough Trade.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're looking at Amazon, it's Amazon versus iTunes. It's always going to be very, very, very similar.
Right.
So just going to record stores, going to record labels, associating like that Washington sound, like the K Records, like girlier.
All right.
You know.
Yeah, you're talking Washington State.
Washington State.
Also Washington, D.C.
Yeah, Washington,
D.C., Discord.
Discord, and just how that affects the bands that they sign, the sounds you're used to, what you expect when you see, in your case or in my case, like that press release from Merge and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and Merge has a little bit of a North Carolina feel because Superchunk kind of runs the label. And I'm always excited when I see that sensibility survive, because one of the sort of sad things, I mean, there's a ton of convenience associated with the fact that everything can kind of rise up scene-wise simultaneously. Mm-hmm. You don't have, you know, there's a blip on the map in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, and then it slowly radiates out, and 3 years later it hits Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
You can put something up on a blog in Mozambique and hear it in Washington, D.C. the same day. But, you know, I do think there are labels that still do have that feel to them. The fact that Discord here in Washington, D.C., it exists entirely to sort of document D.C. music life right now. And, you know, you see Ian MacKaye at shows all around in D.C. And, you know, it still feels like that place. I think that even a label like Secretly Canadian in Bloomington, Indiana has a kind of every place at once, non-coast specific, non-scene. I mean, it doesn't have this, oh, this is hot.
Yeah.
It has a, this is good. You know, and I think that particularly when you think about indie rock labels that excite people the most, they do tend to be based in, you know, Chapel Hill, North Carolina or Bloomington, Indiana.
Yeah, and I remember the first time I probably took note of Nebraska as a place.
That's right. Oh, gosh. Yeah,
Saddle Creek, with Rilo Kiley and Bright Eyes. Rilo Kiley, who has moved on, but, you know, yeah, it's funny. You just, a teenager growing up in California would never consider Nebraska until you hear reference in a song.
It's true. It's probably, those labels have probably gone a long way toward creating less coastal bias in you know, at least among, you know, fans of indie rock music.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a sense of like, ugh, nothing between the, ugh, it's not in Williamsburg. And it's amazing. There is still a Brooklyn bias in coverage of music.
Totally. And writing, from writing about music, it's like the amount of times I wrote this Brooklyn-based duo.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I can't get away from it. But
I feel like Brooklyn is to music what the Beltway is to politics.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't get away from it, and I'm not, and I don't feel in any negative connotation towards saying
it's a lovely place.
The band is Brooklyn-based. But yeah, there is something about it, like, first step to making it. move to Brooklyn.
Oh, God.
There's always, as Stephen is saying, there's always a positive and a negative to the specificity of a place, particularly if the place that you're being associated with has a very strong image. Like, for a while, the specificity being associated with Seattle, whether you were a band or a movie or, you know, whoever, the specificity of that image, on the one hand, it was this idea of really cool, but then on the other hand, it very quickly can flip around and all of a sudden it's just a hug Seattle. You know, like, I've just heard way too much about Seattle. And one of the nice things about a really big city with a very stable reason why people have heard of it, like D.C., for example, is that it doesn't go up and down in coolness in the same way.
Right.
D.C. is always D.C. in the same way that New York is always New York. Now, Brooklyn is different, right? Brooklyn is different. The Bronx is different. But New York as New York is just always New York.
Yeah.
And L.A. is pretty much always L.A. Whereas if you're something like Minneapolis or Seattle or right now Portland.
Oh, my God.
Your fortunes and what it means to be part of that community really is very fluid. And obviously, the association with Portland, I mean, the specificity of the Portland subculture as it's portrayed on something like Portlandia has been great for Portlandia.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time,
maybe not so great for Portland.
It's somewhat limiting, and you wind up with a little bit of a backlash where I'm sure there already exists people in Portland who are like, all right, we're not all weird, twee, you know, feminist bookstore. Like, my guess is there's already some resentment and people, like, always thinking, like, it's Portland. Let's go to the place where all the weird people. Like, it just depends on how you see it. And there is, like I said, for places like Portland or Seattle or Austin.
Austin's another one.
It's kind of your moment, you know. Having your big moment is kind of an up and down.
Any city that has keep blank weird.
Right.
Yeah, which everybody seems to think they're the only city that has it.
I want to sort of go at this a little obliquely, because Stephen was talking about discord in D.C. I want to ask how much this has to do with place specifically, and how often does it have to do at least as much with personality? Because when you talk about D.C. and discord, you have to talk about Ian MacKaye.
Right.
When you talk about varying sort of cultures of making theater, for instance, to talk about something that I know a little bit more about than I do about discord, you can't talk about, say, Paris as a theatrical hub without thinking about the towering personality that is Jacques Lecoq and his influence on the movement theater.
Well, in I can't speak, obviously.
That's his name?
Jacques Lecoq.
I'm not even repeating his name, but I mean, you can't separate Ian MacKaye's personality from Washington D.C. because so much of his personality is tied into this belief in and love of wanting to document what he loves about his neighborhood and his friends. And so there's this intense loyalty to Washington, D.C. that is intrinsic in Ian MacKaye in ways I don't know if that it holds true of Paris and he who I will not name.
Jacques Lecoq. But I think, you know, this plays out in other places. I don't think you get Tony Kushner without New York. So I kind of wonder, are there other examples that y'all can dig up from across the geographic U.S.?
No.
I think one of the things I think is interesting is sometimes you associate the person with the place, but it's not entirely clear how many other things about the place tie into that same thing. It's not like an entire, like when we talked about Seattle, an entire sense of what music in Seattle was during the time that we're talking about, but just a particular, like, for example, right now I'm thinking about Prince in Minneapolis.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not like Minneapolis has a whole bunch of people like Prince. Like, there are other people Prince worked with.
Right. It's more likely to have a lot of people that sound like the Replacements.
Well, exactly. It's not like Minneapolis has a whole, like, Prince scene. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of precursors and other people are out there saying there's this and there's this and there's this. But what I'm saying is culturally, that association between Prince and Minneapolis is very specific.
To that guy.
To that guy. And it's not like people assume that this is the kind of music they make in Minneapolis just because of Prince, you know. And there are certain cities that you don't get as much of a sense at all of in terms of popular music. I'm not talking about the making of music, but current popular music. Like, for example, there's much, certain places have a big scene that's very well known, and other places, like I always think about Philadelphia because it's where I grew up, is that people are kind of like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not that it doesn't have good bands, but I don't know that it has a real specific cohesive kind of scene that has worked its way into popular music. The same
where
way
you think of it as,
my,
where you think of it as Philly music. The
during
way
my lifetime,
of.
I'm saying during my lifetime.
Yeah,
I think
of course
there
you have,
was
well, you
with,
have Philly soul.
With soul,
yeah,
there
I was going
to
say there was kind of a Philly
with
sound
soul, there
thing
was.
For a while.
That's
yeah.
why I'm saying yeah. popular music, right? You know, right now.
Going back to TV,
mm-hmm.
we can't forget to mention Pawnee, Indiana.
Oh, of course. I think Pawnee is a great example.
Shows or movies that are based in the Midwest. Another one I thought of was Juno.
And we should say Pawnee is where Parks and Recreation is located, which many of us know, but you might not.
Yeah, for people who may not have really been to the Midwest much, I have barely been to the Midwest. In some ways, I'm going to infuriate people. In some ways, they're very anonymous, so it could be wherever. I have no. I don't remember. Does Juno take place in Minnesota? Or I don't even know. But
I
in some
do
ways,
not remember where Juno takes place.
In some ways, it's
Minnesota
all...
Minnesota is not the same as Indiana, but I understand. I understand that people like you think that.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways...
It's sort of the same thing as Wisconsin, but that's different.
It's just a character, and it's just like, you know, in some ways, I'm going to boil it down to, like, the friendliness and the quaintness and the... quirkiness a little bit, and I know that
you're also conflating like Prairie Home Companion in there too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean that kind of homespun.
The thing that makes Pawnee work for me as a Midwestern small town is that you do have that niceness and politeness, and certainly I don't know how true it is in Indiana, but it is true in Minnesota that people are a little bit more patient and a little bit more surface polite, right?
Cheerfully passive aggressive.
But what I like about Parks and Rec is that underneath it, there is frequently this sort of competitiveness and like the relationship that Leslie has with the TV host, with that woman who hosts the TV show, the local Pawnee Today or whatever it is.
I have to tell you, this feels like gotcha journalism.
In what way?
That way. You put gotcha on my face.
After the break. Where is Leslie Knope actually born?
Pawnee!
We will pull out the world map and speculate wildly.
Oh, God, not the gotcha dancers.
That is very Midwestern to me because it's very competitive, and yet very often that woman is like, oh, hey, hey. But, like, they hate each other. So I like that part about it, is that sweetness is cut with a little bit of...
Yeah.
Well, anyway, come and find us on Facebook and at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us about things that you love that have a very effective sense of place. And or find us on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. So in our second segment today, it is that time again. We are going to have...
Oh, I hear paper rattling.
We are going to have a quiz. It is time...
Does paper rattle?
For a quiz.
Now
this quiz, here's what this quiz is based on. People who follow me on Twitter know this, but I have recently become fascinated with an archive I found online of archived USA Today weekly TV ratings.
Oh.
Somebody went through and scanned.
Yeah, I saw you tweeting this, yeah.
Somebody went through and scanned USA Today pages. And this is kind of why I trust them, is that they're scans of USA Today pages. That report the weekly Nielsen ratings.
Now, is this one that
USA
do, like,
Today used to have a whole page where they would list all the shows for the week. And the,
that was back when I worked there, and I probably know the person who had to copy edit that.
Yeah.
Now, was this in the era where they one of the papers that would give you the top 10, but also the bottom 5?
Yes. Yes. Oh. So this particular one, I did. I went back 20 years. So this stuff is from this same week. In 1993.
So Jess is going to do great on this.
I might do better than you might expect.
I was going to say, she might do just as well as you. I wouldn't
jump in on. We'll see.
When Jess was 5 and I was in college.
So we will go around. You will each get 3 questions. And these were... It's a little easier than usual because instead of giving you 4 answers, in most cases I give you 3 answers to choose from. So, hey.
So we're each going to get at least one.
You really should. You really should just by chance. Okay. On April 12th, 1993, ABC ran an episode of a series called American Detective. Stephen, was it A, a documentary series about police officers, B, a comedy featuring Gerald McRaney as an inept cop, or C, a drama spun off of The Commish? American Detective on
ABC.
Was
The Commish around in the early 90s?
Stephen Thompson employs deductive reasoning.
I'm trying, man. McCraney seems like it's from your head. The documentary doesn't sound likely. I'm gonna have to go with The Commish.
It is a documentary series.
Hosted
by John Bunnell, the same guy who does like World's Wildest Police Video.
I managed to eliminate from consideration the two that it wasn't and still got it wrong.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Trey Graham, the sixth highest show of the week, aired at 9:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 13th on ABC after Roseanne. Was it A, Dixie, starring Dixie Carter, B, Delta, starring Delta Burke, or C, Dudley, starring Dudley Moore?
I'm going with Delta.
It was Delta, yeah. Although I should point out Dudley was also a show.
Nice.
I did not
During
know that.
Same week, there was
Alrighty
a show,
then.
Dudley.
Wow.
Delta and Dudley were both shows, but it was Delta.
Yep.
Wow. Right, my palms are sweating after hearing those two rounds.
Jess Gittner. On Friday night, April 16th, CBS ran a drama called Bodies of Evidence. Who starred in Bodies of Evidence? None of these. No one would know this question, so don't worry about it. A, Lee Horsley. He was also Matt Houston.
Mm-hmm. Matt Houston. And a grizzled old prospector, grizzled old sheriff in Django Unchained.
Yes, he was. Okay. Lee Horsley. B, George Clooney. Or C, both.
Whoa.
Ooh.
A, Lee Horsley. B, George Clooney. Or C, both.
I'm going to try to lean on what little George Clooney knowledge I have, and I'm going to just go with A.
Yeah, that would be my guess.
It is actually both.
I was going to say both. It's too weird to not be both.
It is actually both. Well, see, right, it is too weird not to be both, but I was kind of hoping that someone would conclude that was also too weird and came from my head.
Yeah.
I'm trying to fake out Stephen. all right, Stephen, on Sunday night, April 18th, Fox ran a sitcom starring Taya Leone called Flying Blind.
Yeah.
What was notable about it? A, it ran at 10 p.m. when Fox no longer programs. B, it included a rarely seen, mostly bare breast. Or C, it got such low ratings that it registered as zero.
Ooh. I'm going to go with zero.
It ran at 10 p.m.
God dang it!
Which was then the time slot where Fox ran its local news. So that would have been extremely strange.
Yeah. They used to program at 10.
Not as strange as getting a zero.
True that.
They used to program at 10, apparently.
Wow. Nothing would get a zero. That's a terrible guess.
Treegram. The lowest-rated show of the week on broadcast television starred, among others, both Hank Azaria and Yeardley Smith from The Simpsons. What was it called? And I'm not going to give you answers, but I will tell you that the main character's first name was Herman.
Yeah, I know this.
I'm glad I don't know.
Wow.
really? You don't remember?
I do not remember this. Herman's Hermits.
No! Herman's Hermits.
Stephen Thompson.
It's Herman's Head.
It is Herman's Head.
That was the lowest rated show. That was around for a few years.
Of the week. All right. Jess Gittner. The show during the most recently reported week that had the most viewers was The Big Bang Theory, watched by about 17.2 million people. Knowing that, how many people do you think watched an April 14th, 1993 rerun of Coach, starring Craig T. Nelson? About 8 million? About 16 million? About 28 million? Or about 35 million? Remember, the top-rated show of the entire week a couple weeks ago. It was Big Bang Theory, 17.2 million people. How many do you think watched an April 14th, 1993 rerun of Coach? 8, 16, 28, or 35?
I'm leaning towards the higher numbers. You know, we didn't have DVR back then. I'm going to go with, C, 28?
That is correct.
Yep.
28, yes. About 28 million.
One down.
Watching a rerun.
I have not gotten one of mine
right Coach, yet. Not just Coach, but a rerun of Coach.
And I'm glad I actually know what Coach is. I watch Coach.
It was on after Home Improvement.
Yep.
Which at the time...
Luther! That's all I know from Coach.
All right. Stephen Thompson.
Yes.
Saturday night at 10 p.m., CBS ran a show called Raven. Raven was a person, but what did he do? A, he was a doctor. B, he was a pirate. C, he was a ninja. D, he was a magician.
Boy.
Doctor, pirate.
This is different from, ninja, this is different from, it's musician, not Raven magician. Simone.
No, this is.
That's so Raven.
Raven's first name was not That So.
Okay. I'm going to go with magician.
He was a ninja.
Ninja.
I am 0-for-3. I have gotten I think I've gotten everything that you have asked of Trey or Jess.
Ooh, he was a ninja.
Hi.
All right. Trey Graham. NBC had on Friday night an hour-long series called Secret Service that had the involvement of the child of a president. Who was it? A, Jimmy Carter's daughter, Amy. B, Ronald Reagan's son, Ron Jr. Or C, Gerald Ford's son, Stephen.
Ooh, I was going to say Ron Jr. I'm going to say Ron Jr.
I would have said Amy.
It is Stephen Ford.
See,
I'm not just
confident that it was Ron Jr. until you said Stephen Ford.
Stephen Ford is the blonde actor. Yeah. For anyone who doesn't know, Stephen Ford is the blonde actor who, among other things, is Meg Ryan's boyfriend in When Harry Met Sally, who she goes to the airport with and runs into Billy Crystal. So that's Stephen Ford. Jess Gittner. How many episodes aired of the TV series adaptation of A League of Their Own?
Ooh.
A, 5, B, 8, C, 13, D, 18.
Did you give that question to me on purpose?
No. 5, 8, 13, 18.
I'm going to go with 5.
The answer is 5.
Oh, my
God. Wow, well done.
They ordered,
I'm raising the roof.
They ordered 6 and only ever aired 5.
Wow. They just not even bothered.
They made 6 and apparently left 1. According to Wikipedia, I mean, the information for these quizzes comes from a combination of IMDb, Wikipedia.
And your own brain.
yeah. Well, the fake stuff comes from my own brain.
I always love when a show gets canceled. Like, I used to watch this reality show called Playing It Straight that I may have mentioned on the show before. And it was a 6-episode, limited-run reality show in which they aired 3 of the 6 and replaced it when they canceled it with, syndicated reruns of America's Funniest Home Videos. Right. But, they did not even try.
Stephen is still mad.
I am still mad.
Well, that brings us to our... I think Jess was the clear winner of that quiz.
Yeah.
And, surprising.
I went 0-3, so it's either her or Trey.
It certainly wasn't you.
And that... How many did you get, Trey?
I think I got... 2.
Did you get? Then we tied.
Maybe I only got one. I didn't get Herman's head.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that makes Jess Gittner the big winner.
All right.
And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, it starts with sad news. From about a month ago, a singer-songwriter that I really love named Jason Molina died at 39. Very sad story. One of the labels that put out some of his stuff, Graveface Records, has assembled a benefit album, a very robust and generous 34-song, more than 2-hour-long benefit album, obviously put together very, very quickly of performances of some of his songs. It's called Weary Engine Blues, a tribute to Jason Molina. And it's got a lot of my favorite mopes. It's got Jonathan Myberg from Shearwater. It's got Mark Kozlik from Red House Painters and Sun Kill Moon. It's got Will Oldham. A lot of the sort of sad singers you would expect. Obviously, it's uneven, but there's some lovely, lovely stuff in there. And the email that came with it for those of us who bought it, there was an email from the owner of Graveface Records, and it says, I'm quoting here, "Because of you, we were able to give Molina's family a staggering amount of money. We will keep passing on profits from this to his family for days, weeks, months, and years to come, and that makes life worth living." And when you see that from, and obviously this is not a gigantic record label, but it just made me feel like there are good people in the world of music.
There are.
Yeah.
There are good people in the world of music. Thank you, Stephen. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Well, a few months ago, back in October of 2012, a play opened in New York starring our guy Asif Manvi, who, we all know from The Daily Show. Funny guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not so much in this play.
Yeah.
It's a rip-roaring play. The play is called Disgraced. It is by a writer called Ayad Akhtar. And today, as we tape, this Monday, the 15th of April, also tax day. Have you done your taxes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama.
Oh, wonderful. Oh.
Which means that this rather tense, energetic play about ethnic identity, faith, personal identity is going to get produced all over the country.
Nice.
It's a quick 90-minute play that sort of grapples with issues of family history, of Islam in the age of Islamism and extreme religious beliefs. And it's one of those plays that had people talking. And now, as I said, because it's won the Pulitzer, it's going to be like Rabbit Hole and Proof and things like that. It's going to get produced all over the country, which is great. So that's making me happy.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Again, called Disgraced by Ayad Akhtar.
Disgraced. Thank you, Trey Graham. Jess Gittner, what is making you happy this week?
Well, surprisingly, it's a book. one of the perks of everyone moving out is they've been throwing all their crap away.
Yes, they have.
And I found this book on the giveaway shelf. My gaydar led me to it.
it was pinging.
Yeah. I hadn't heard of it, and I picked it up. It's called The Miseducation of Cameron Post. It came out last year in February, so I'm a little behind.
Mm-hmm.
But it was reviewed on NPR. You can read it on NPR. It was reviewed by Melinda Lowe, who used to write for After Ellen and is a YA author. It is about a teenager named Cameron Post who lives in eastern Montana, which I hear is the less attractive part of the state.
Yes, it is.
Starts out when she's 12. Her parents die, and this is not giving anything away. And her first emotion is she's glad that they didn't know that she, before she found out this news, she was kissing a girl. But it's a coming out story in some ways. It's it follows a typical path of feelings, heartbreak, mm-hmm. and then I'm actually only just over halfway through the book. Her aunt sends her to a basically a gay therapy camp. Mm-hmm. So I've just gotten there. I don't know how it ends, but I will say
nobody tell Jess.
I will say the character is a movie lover. She watches films that she even thinks might have like a hint of gay characters in them, and it takes place in 1993. Coincidentally, basically.
Yeah.
So in that way, it's sort of like a journey through like lesbian media, but it's a YA novel, but it's good for adults too. I stayed up late this morning reading it, and it is great. I've read a few. I've tried to make my way through the lesbian canon, if you will, and this one has been the most enjoyable for me so far.
Nice.
So highly recommended. It's called The Miseducation of Cameron Post by Emily Danforth.
By the way, I hear that the best girl in all of roller derby is lesbian canon. So, I don't know.
Boy.
It's what occurred to me. So, here's what's making me happy this week. I have spoken many, many times in this space about College a Cappella.
Yes.
I know what
I
this
have,
is.
I have defended it against haters and doubters. And people who can't sing and resent people who can.
We're all just jealous.
Haters are just jealous. And I got a message on Twitter from the people organizing the International Championships of Collegiate Acapella, which is the event that is immortalized in Pitch Perfect, by the way.
Nice.
And they said, well, you know, if you wanted to come, we could get you a ticket, of course. You know, it's one of those things where people, you know, people not infrequently for things that are out of town will say to me like, oh, we could get you into this. And I'm always like, oh, that's, you know, but I can't because it's out of town. I don't live there. And for this, all of a sudden I thought like, I should do that.
Yeah.
I should definitely do that. So so on April 20th, which will be just as you are receiving this podcast or the day after, I will be going to New York to attend the International Championships of Collegiate Acapella.
Nice.
And I will be going with a pal who is also a fan of SAME. And I will be enjoying some doo-wops and some shooby-doos and undoubtedly some mouth percussion. And I could not be more excited. It was a really, really nice offer.
This is definitely the first time this week I've heard the phrase mouth percussion.
That's because you don't do enough cappella singing. Trying around. And so I'm very, very excited. And I'm sure that I will report back about how great it was and how awesome.
If you don't bring back some
was.
Sound clips, I'm going to be very upset.
Well, we're trying to work out whether that's going to be possible. And in the meantime, I'm just super happy about it and very excited and appreciate the offer. And I can't wait.
No way. Absolutely.
I can't wait. I'm really excited. So that's what's making me happy this week is I'm getting out of town and listening to some good singing.
Awesome.
And that's me. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker.
Wait, isn't there an a cappella version of that somewhere?
There is somewhere. You can follow Glenn.
It has mouth percussion.
You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer and guest this week, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. She's developing quite the fan club. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your feet to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
You bet.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you from the new HQ next week.